Welcome, everyone, to our third session on biblical responses to current questions. Today, we're doing a little bit of pinch hitting because Professor Stephen Toole is ill and he cannot be with us today. But we're going to stick with the topic of anti-Semitism because it's so important. And one of the handouts you have is an article that CBS News put out in response to the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue. It's called "The Danger of Taking Biblical Passages Out of Context." And I ran across it yesterday, and because we're remembering that tragedy, even today in the city of Pittsburgh, that it's really important for us to reflect on that and reflect on the role of anti-Semitism in our culture. So you can just take this home, read it, throw it away, ponder it, whatever you want. The other thing we're going to do before we have some time for discussion is listen to a sermon by Dr. Amy Jill Levine. She was a longtime professor at Vanderbilt University, and she's an unusual scholar in that she's Jewish, but she studies the New Testament. And she's very, very good. She knows her stuff. And so we're going to listen to a sermon that she preached in 2021 during Holy Week at National Cathedral. And she may talk about the Episcopal Church and their stance on anti-Semitism and other things, but it's not very different at all from the PCUSA. So I think you'll find that to be a good introduction to how we look at the Bible and how we look at Jews and how we remember that Jesus was a Jew, and that will never change. So let's open with prayer. Gracious God, thank you for bringing us here together, both in person and online. Please be with our dear friend, Steve Toole, and bring him healing and bring him back to us next week. And guide our discussion. May we be thoughtful, and may we push away some of our ideas and maybe think a little bit differently, as the sermon encouraged us to do this morning. In Jesus' name, amen.
Good morning. My enormous gratitude goes to the people of the National Cathedral for their hospitality and generosity in allowing me to speak this morning. And it also goes to the Episcopal Diocese of Washington, who at their convention on January 30th approved a resolution on addressing the anti-Semitic impact of lectionary readings for Holy Week. It is an honor to be with you, and it is a blessing to know that you are attending to the lectionary, because there's much work to be done. Commandments, the Decalogue, one of the centerpieces of what the Church calls the Old Testament, and we Jews call the Tanakh. It includes Psalm 19, which proclaims, "The law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The decrees of the Lord are sure, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is clear, enlightening the eyes." Psalm 19 has a special role in the Jewish tradition. We Jews recite its last verse, "Let the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart be acceptable to you, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer," at the conclusion of the Amidah prayer, and we recite the entire psalm every Shabbos, that is, every Sabbath morning. This celebration of the mitzvot, the commandments that guide our paths, harness our evil inclinations, and make us a covenant community, finds natural analogies in the New Testament. Numerous passages complement Exodus 20 and Psalm 19. The gospel reading to complement the Decalogue could have been the section in the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus says, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law. I have not come to abolish, but to fulfill." It could have been the section of the sermon traditionally called the Antitheses, the teachings where Jesus begins, "You have heard it said," and adds, "but I say to you." These are not antitheses. These are extensions. When Jesus says, "You have heard that it was said to those of ancient times, you shall not murder," one of the Ten Commandments, "and whoever murders shall be liable to judgment," an antithesis would be, "But I say to you, lock, load, and take out as many as your automatic weapon, permitted to you by the Second Amendment, but not by the Bible, allows." Jesus does not abrogate the commandments, he extends them. "But I say to you, if you are angry with a brother or sister, you will be liable to judgment. And if you insult a brother or sister, you will be liable to the council. And if you say, you fool, you will be liable to the hell of fire." This is what Rabbinic Judaism calls building a fence about the Torah. We protect the commandments by making new laws to ensure that we do not violate the primary ones. Similarly to the commandment, "You shall not commit adultery," Jesus tells his followers that even thinking about it is tantamount to doing it. And after forbidding this thinking, he provides the verbal equivalent of a cold shower. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one of your members than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. Now, for those thinking that Jesus does away with that eye for an eye statement and so replaces Old Testament retributive violence with New Testament distributive justice, again, wrong. No one in ancient Israel carries out the eye for an eye statement, and Rabbinic Judaism says it cannot be carried out literally. Rather, it's a legal principle that says in the case of physical mutilation, if you lose an eye or a limb, the victim should receive some sort of compensation. When Jesus says, "You have heard it said, an eye for an eye, but I say to you, anyone who strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other," he's not opposing Torah, he's changing the subject. There's a huge difference between losing a limb and getting a backhanded slap meant to humiliate rather than to do damage. Jesus observed the Ten Commandments and the other 603 commandments, as Jews traditionally number them, and he taught his followers to do the same. In Mark chapter 10, he tells a would-be disciple, "You know the commandments, you shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness," and so on. He debated fellow Jews on how to observe the mitzvot, the commandments, since Torah does not come with an instruction manual. And in many cases, as we've seen, he makes the law more rather than less stringent. Regarding the epistolary reading to complement Exodus 20 and Psalm 19, the lectionary could have cited numerous passages from Paul's epistle to the Romans. For example, Paul's insistence that the law is holy and the commandments holy and just and good. Or Paul's comments about his Jewish relatives, they are Israelites, and to them belong the adoption, the glory, the covenants, the giving of the law, the worship, and the promises. To them belong the patriarchs, and from them, according to the flesh, comes the Messiah, who is over all, God blessed forever. Amen. Or Paul's summary of Torah, "Owe no one anything except to love one another. For the one who loves another has fulfilled the law, the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and any other commandment," are summed up in this word, "Love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law." Such lectionary readings would have been especially helpful, especially to those Christians who view the Old Testament as less good, out of date, primitive, barbaric, a proclaimer of a God of wrath, and, well, Jewish, while the New Testament is the new and improved, up-to-date, replacement, civilized proclaimer of a God of love. This view is wrong, and those who hold it are not only misguided, they're heretics. The God who created the world, the God who called Abraham, spoke to Moses, covenanted with David, and chose the people Israel, is the same God to whom Jesus, in typical Jewish fashion, taught his disciples to call Avinu, the Hebrew, or Abuna, the Aramaic, our Father. When I get this nonsense from my students about the Old Testament God of wrath versus the New Testament God of love, I am inclined to cite 1 Psalm 23, "The Lord is my shepherd, who leads me beside still waters and restores my soul." And then the Gospels, where people are condemned to the outer darkness where there is wailing and gnashing of teeth. The Psalms of Israel offer a good shepherd. The Gospels have a sadistic dentist. Now, of course, that's not a fair analogy. One should never compare the best of one tradition with more problematic materials in another. But the point should be clear. It's the same God. And for those who insist that the commandments, the mitzvot of God, are impossible to follow, they're wrong too. Paul tells us in Philippians that concerning righteousness under the law, he was blameless. Luke describes the parents of John the Baptist, Zechariah and Elizabeth, as righteous before God, living blamelessly according to all the commandments and regulations of the Lord. And if a Jew misstepped, there's always repenting and atoning. Jesus, like his fellow Jews, followed the Decalogue and the other commandments. Jesus, like his fellow Jews, recognized that God gave Israel the Torah out of love, and they followed the commandments not to earn divine love, but in response to it. Jesus, like his fellow Jews, also realized that following the commandments were a way of maintaining their identity as empire after empire. Egypt, Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome, and so on, wanted them to assimilate, to accept the beliefs and practices of the majority. Following Torah has always been a form of multiculturalism, a way for a minoritized group to retain, proclaim, and celebrate its distinct identity. With Exodus 20 and Psalm 19, the church had such wonderful opportunities for finding appropriate New Testament readings, but instead of wonder, we get whiplash. While the psalm rejoices, the decrees of the Lord are sure, making wise the simple. Paul in 1 Corinthians states, in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom. God decided through the foolishness of our proclamation to save those who believe. The two Old Testament readings celebrate the Torah that makes one wise. The reading from 1 Corinthians appears to undercut the Torah's ability to inculcate wisdom. For the Christian worshiper, this reading thus appears to undercut the Torah's importance and sever the link between the Old Testament and the New. And that's not the message we should take. Paul is not seeking to undermine Torah, nor is Paul moving from Judaism to Christianity. Indeed, the word Christian appears in none of his letters. Paul has rather moved from a non-messianic form of Judaism to the movement that proclaimed Jesus Lord. He has moved from a tradition that was waiting for the Messiah to come to one that proclaimed that the Messiah had come and would surely and shortly come back. When Paul tells us in his epistle to the Philippians that he was circumcised on the eighth day, a member of the people Israel of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew born of Hebrews, and as to the law, a Pharisee, he's not denying his identity, he's boasting. Granted, Pharisees do get some bad press in the Gospels, but that's because they represented a viable alternative to the messianic proclamation of Jesus and his followers. Pharisees were a lay-led movement whose members were known for walking the walk as well as talking the talk, and for interpreting the Torah to make it more egalitarian, for showing the people how they could be like priests in the temple and how they could make their meals comparable to the sacrifices in the temple. So why do we get the impression that Paul had a negative view of Torah? To understand Paul's view, we need to understand his audience. Paul is writing to pagans who have eschewed both local and empire-wide gods and turned to the God of Israel. The one Bible they have is not the New Testament. That hadn't been written yet. Their scripture, the one 2 Timothy proclaims is inspired by God and useful for teaching, reproof, correction, and training in righteousness, is the Greek translation of what came to be called the Old Testament. But here's the problem. Paul does not want his Gentile believers doing all that Moses commanded. To the contrary, those Gentiles are not to practice circumcision, not to practice the Jewish dietary concerns, not to celebrate Jewish holidays. Why? Because they're Gentiles, not Jews, and Paul does not want them converting to Judaism. Paul, Jew that he is, knows that in the Messianic age, the Gentiles will turn to worship the God of Israel, but they do so as Gentiles and not as Jews. When the prophet Zechariah predicts that in the Messianic age, 10 Gentiles will grab hold of the Jew and say, take me with you to Zion, he does not then have these pilgrims say, circumcise us when we get there. For Paul, the Messianic age is the time when Jews and Gentiles together participate in the worship of the one God. The Jews retain their distinctive practices. The Gentiles follow those commandments that fit their new life outside of paganism, worshiping the one God, rejecting idolatry, hallowing God's name, honoring parents, and refraining from murder, adultery, stealing, bearing false witness, and coveting. The one missing commandment here is the Sabbath, which those early Gentile followers may not have celebrated. Instead, they commemorated the Lord's Day, Sunday, today, the day they proclaimed Jesus had been raised from the dead. The lectionary starts with the Decalogue, and the psalm insists the decrees of the Lord are sure, making wise the simple. And then we have the whiplash of 1 Corinthians that proclaims, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise. And then John 2, the temple incident. What has Jesus violently stopping temple activities to do with the Ten Commandments? Most commentators, including Episcopal sermon guides that I found online, insist that Jesus was protesting temple economics. He was condemning a system where the poor had to borrow money to offer a sacrifice, a system that placed vendors in the court of the Gentiles and so prevented those Gentiles from having meaningful worship. A system that relied on money changers who extorted funds from pilgrims, or as one Episcopal source puts it, a system that inserted, quote, an unnecessary barrier between God and the children of God. The impression the congregation then gets is that the temple epitomizes not the Ten Commandments, but the 10 sins, from idolatry to Sabbath worship to murder to stealing, you name it. And that the Gospel of John makes explicit none of this is only one of many problems here. The Gospel reading threatens to create or reinforce the pernicious association of Jews with worshiping money and the false stereotype that Jews equate money with righteousness and poverty with sin. Anyone who has read the Torah, the Decalogue with its laws against stealing and coveting, the whole Jewish Bible, as well as the rest of the entire rabbinic tradition with its repeated insistence on care for society's vulnerable, the poor, the widow, the orphan, and the resident alien, would know this stereotype to be incorrect. And if not, a production of Fiddler on the Roof would have made the point. The temple offered sacrifices on behalf of everyone so that the poor were always included. It operated on a sliding scale adjusted for income, so that when Mary and Joseph visit the temple according to the Gospel of Luke chapter 2, they offer a sacrifice according to what is stated in the law of the Lord, a pair of turtle doves or two young pigeons, and that was the gift of the poor. And Leviticus states that even if the small birds were too expensive, there's a vegetarian option. As for the temple as a place of quiet meditation, wrong again. We're talking about the ancient temple, not the National Cathedral during worship. Ancient temples were loud, busy, and crowded, as any reader of the gospel should know, given all those teachers, including Jesus himself, holding court there. We know that Jesus' followers continued to worship and even contribute to the temple, as the book of Acts notes on several occasions. When Paul in Romans 4 details the benefits of the Jewish tradition, he includes the term worship, latreia in Greek, the Hebrew would be avodah, temple worship. Okay. Had Jesus denounced the entire temple system for which the vendors and the money changers were necessary, then not a single one would follow about the point. And should we understand this passage in John's gospel? Here are two possibilities. First, perhaps Jesus, like the Pharisees, is seeking to enact Exodus 19:6, the chapter right before today's lectionary selection. Exodus 19:6 proclaims, "You shall be for me a priestly kingdom and a holy nation." Perhaps he, like the Pharisees, is extending the temple holiness to all the people. When Jesus says, take these things out of here, stop making my father's house a marketplace, he's paraphrasing Zechariah 14, which describes the messianic age. On that day, there shall be inscribed on the bells of horses holy to the Lord, and the cooking pots in the house of the Lord shall be as holy as the bowls in front of the altar, and every cooking pot in Jerusalem and Judah shall be sacred to the Lord of hosts. So that all who sacrifice may come and use them, and there shall no longer be traitors in the house of the Lord of hosts on that day. Taking out the vendors is a sign of the messianic age. And second, rather than use this text to promote a negative view of Jewish practice by inventing economic or ethnic problems, why not use it to promote a positive view of Jesus? In John 2, Jesus refocuses temple activity from the sacrificial offerings to himself, which is entirely appropriate for the one John the Baptist calls the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. And these words provide comfort, for by the time John wrote his gospel, the Romans had destroyed the temple. Jesus claims the temple is his father's house, and his disciples remember the quote from Psalm 69, "Zeal for your house will consume me." And much could be said here for memory and for reassessing our histories in light of later knowledge. It can take time to see the full effect of an action or a quote, or a lectionary reading. The lectionary reading today, which in common cultural imagination moves from Old Testament law and ritual to New Testament grace and spirit, threatens to suggest that Judaism is outdated or more likely failed, perverse, exploitative, or impossible, and that Jesus comes to replace it and erase it. Christian teaching need not malign Jewish tradition in order to make Jesus look good. I'm a Jew. I don't worship Jesus as Lord and Savior, but I have spent my life studying him and being inspired by him and learning from him. He's a splendid teacher. If I can see how profound and provocative he is without having to malign Judaism, Surely Christians can do the same. The incorrect stereotypes of Judaism, stereotypes this lectionary threatens to reproduce and disseminate, lead to Jew hatred. And we have seen on our own US soil what that looks like. Sometimes texts need a warning label. Sometimes lectionaries, and not just for Holy Week, need to be revised. If symbols of slavery can be removed from flagpoles in public parks, why can't Christians change Sunday readings that can easily lead to prejudice against Jews? If people can be reprimanded or canceled for making comments that reinforce the sins of sexism, racism, homophobia, transphobia, ableism, and so on, why can't ministers be trained to follow the commandment about not bearing false witness against their neighbor? If we are all to be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, please, God, let us stop the bigotry that comes in the name of religion, and let us prevent the gospel of love from being turned into a gospel of hate. The resolution of this diocese includes not only the concern for adjusting Holy Week lectionary readings, it also suggests that the Episcopal Church advocate that other denominations using the revised common lectionary consider the same changes. Godspeed on your work, and please, God, help others to follow your lead. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable to you, Adonai, Tsuri, Vago Ali, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. Amen.
Any thoughts? What was your reaction to her sermon? She speaks very quickly, and if you want to watch it again, it's on YouTube, very easy to find. She's amazing. No, she knows her stuff. Anyone else? Well, I think she gave us a lot to think about. And I think we're ready to sort of begin a bit of discussion. And I would strongly recommend you checking other things out that she has online or her writings, because she really is pretty remarkable. And so now let's talk a little bit about our own experiences with attitudes toward Jews. As your faith was developing, what was your understanding of how Jews were represented in the New Testament? I'm thinking about when you were growing up, when you were a young adult, and then we can talk about how that changed, but what did you grow up thinking, that Jews were all the bankers who were out to get your money? The stereotypes are not good.
This is an extension maybe, but not so much the Jews broadly, but I was interested that she gave the Pharisees a pretty sympathetic description. And they were always the ones who were wrong in Jesus's descriptions, or his, you know, like, woe to you stuff. And so I thought that was interesting, and a very different look at the Pharisees.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And the thing about the Pharisees, from some of the things I've read, and believe, you know, we don't really know what we're talking about. We're just doing our best. But a lot of it came from human frustration and anger that Jesus was happy to share.
Well, my father was a banker, and he was not a man who had friends. But he had Berkey and Norm. They were two friends of his who were Jewish. They were so good to our family. And in fact, when we very quickly, they had a home construction business, and we very quickly needed to build an addition onto our home for my grandparents to come live with us, Berkey and Norm were on the case. And it happened faster than any construction project I ever know of. So for me growing up, when I thought of Jewish people, I thought of Berkey and Norm. Forget what I was told at church. Forget that. That's who they were. That's who they were. They were my dad's friends, and they were so kind and so generous. Those were Jews to me.
But we do have stereotypes that we have to deal with. I know that it was always a problem for me because there were being raised as a Southern Baptist. I mean, you look at the Jews and it was like, the Jews, they're almost subhuman, basically. But of course, you know, as a Southern Baptist also, you look down upon the Catholics as well. It wasn't just the Jews, it was the Catholics. So yeah, we just, it was a different time, and a time of, I mean, more of a time of hate anything, that's anybody that's different. You know, we always have the others, you know, anti the others.
I had a lot of thoughts when she was preaching, but just one of them was that if you raise what Judaism teaches in what we see as Christianity to its highest level, there is no difference on the essentials. But with Judaism, it's been associated with a race and a location, a geographic location. So that's one thing that separates us Christians from Jews. And I have Jewish friends that the difference they see is that Jesus was a great rabbi, but not the Son of God. So we're talking about things that are very high up in terms of truth, and then lower down in terms of specifics, like race, location, whether you want to call Jesus the Son of God or a great rabbi. So those are just some random thoughts, no answers.
I have one, I think, kind of amusing story that might reflect some of how life was like in the South, maybe in the, say, the 1940s and 50s. My mother was a singer, a choir director, and a soloist, and she basically sang for all the weddings and funerals in our small city. And she was a very busy, busy woman, and sometimes she would have several funerals in a row, and she would just quickly drive from one place to another. But she did both Jewish and Christian weddings and funerals. And one day, she finished up with a Christian service at a funeral home. Then she went to the synagogue, and she kind of messed up. And after she had sung one solo, then she sang one that was like all about Jesus. And she thought before she finished, oh, I have really messed up. But the people there, they were, like John said, they respected Jesus, and they were just fine hearing her sing about Jesus, because after all, she was a Christian, but she was also very happy to sing among her Jewish friends. And so, for what that's worth, it's just stayed with me. This was before I was born, when she still had lots of energy.
I was going to just briefly add to that, because everybody's experience is different. We do have a group here that's looking at ways we can push back on anti-Semitism. I don't know if any of you came to the One Hit Wonder that we did, I'm going to say last semester, too long at Pitt. And we talked about different things that can be done. And we talked about falsehoods that come up. But I don't know if any of you have ever studied with a rabbi. And it wasn't a long course, but I took a 2-month course with my rabbi, Rabbi Mahler from Temple Emmanuel. And I remember so clearly the very first night of class, one of the first things he said was, I want to be your rabbi. And as your rabbi, I want you to be the best Christians you can be. That mutual respect going back and forth. When I was at Duquesne, yes, I will put them on the spot. And we were singing in Hebrew at one of the synagogues in Oakland, actually on the edge of Squirrel Hill. Some of the Catholic boys were making fun of what they called the beanies they had to wear. And I said, you know, You know all those crucifixes in your dorm rooms and in your classrooms? Jews don't do anything to those. So you need to be respectful. I know Rabbi Mahler has done seminars here. I don't know if he's doing anything now that he's retired. I often wished that I told both of them, I wish that he and Jim Gilchrist would write a book together, because the intellectual firepower of those two. I will tell you, if you are interested in this subject going forward, what came out of the one-hit wonder, there is an amazing documentary called Paperclips. And it is about the only child-run Holocaust museum in the world at the time. It's in Kentucky. It's run by middle school students. And just, we talk about Godwink, so I will briefly tell you that many of the things they had, they decided they would collect paper clips because that was representative of defiance against the Nazis, and it was an easy thing to do. So they wrote, famous people said, Henry Winkler sent them paper clips, all sorts of people sent them paper clips, and they wanted to display at their museum one of the rail cars from the camps. And what they went through to get it is a whole story in itself, but they were finally granted an old gauge rail car that had been used to transport Jews to the camps. And it came to America, and then they had to get it on a different thing to get it from New Jersey to Kentucky. And in one of those coincidences of fate, that rail car was leaving New Jersey on September 11th.
Wow.
And if I can just add something, was it Norm and?
Berkey and Norm.
Berkey and Norm. Well, I think that really is an important point when we think about the other and the stereotypes we create about the other. When the other is an abstraction, we instinctively, all humans, create distance from the other. It's just natural. When the other becomes a real person to us, whether it's a person living in poverty, a person who is homeless, a person who is Jewish, a person who is somehow different from us, when they become a real person to us, then some of those stereotypes just melt away because they're real human beings. And so that, you know, that was a brilliant idea.
I have an example of that with my own father. He was very, very bigoted. Really did not like Jews at all, really hated Jews. However, his baby sister married a Jew, and then all of a sudden, Jews were okay. It's just amazing how that happens. And John, just one of the things I wanted to dovetail.
If I read the Bible, I don't see that Jesus ever stopped being a Jew. I was raised as a Catholic, and I know he didn't become a Catholic. Or Presbyterian, or a Methodist, or, you know, a Christian, he was a Jew. But the thing is, now when you think of a Jew, you think of a religion and a culture. But I don't think Jesus would be limiting himself to a culture.
Well, I think a lot of what we look at when we call when we look at anti-Semitism, I think we're really talking about anti-Judaism more so than the racial thing, although some people do think of it in terms of the racial stigma, but I think most of it is really just anti-Judaism.
So I think your story about your father and him changing his views kind of, that brings us to the next question, which I think you probably can answer. How has your understanding of Jews and your approach changed in recent decades? And especially maybe after Tree of Life, maybe not, but how has it changed? How have you matured in your opinion?
I know I've had to change because I was taught that Jews were the ones that killed Jesus. I mean, he killed Jesus, so they're all bad. He made a broad brush. However, did he really? I mean, did the Jews really kill Jesus, or was it the Romans? And then also, It was brought up at one point in one sermon by another pastor that actually Jesus allowed himself to be killed.
That's absolutely right. A couple of years ago, Jim Davison did a series on John and talked about the passages that seemed to point to the Jews, but in reality, it was just pointing to the Jewish leaders who were somewhat problematic, but ultimately the decision was Roman.
And I'll just chime in. There's a hymn that we sing during Holy Week. Ah, Holy Jesus. And it comes around to the idea that, you know, how have I failed? And it's, I crucified you. Which I think is a something to keep in mind. We all, in our own sinfulness, transgress against God and against Jesus. And so to point at the Jews is kind of like a comfortable way of shifting blame.
I don't know if this is accurate or not, but I took a Bible study course that was a couple years long. I studied different sections of the Bible. And one of the ladies said that Roman citizens could stop what we would say like a trial in process, could stop it and say, we need to afford this man a real trial. This is kind of, it was kind of presented like a circus of people screaming. You know what I mean? But a Roman citizen could say, stop this chaos, we need a trial. And none of the Roman citizens spoke up. They just let all those leaders storm and the outcome.
Well, like Chuck said, it was meant to be. And so Jesus knew that that was his fate. Yeah, we're all guilty.
I think the question was, has your opinion changed today? I think looking at what's going on today, the annihilation of Hamas in Gaza, I think the average person sees the destruction going on there, and I'm not sure how you justify 1,500 people of yours being killed, and in return, you're killing tens of thousands of others, including the pedestrians. I think that affects everyone, not just the Jews in Israel, but the Jews in the United States. And I think you're seeing that. That's what you're seeing now. You're seeing people are holding them responsible for what's happening in Israel. And I think, has your opinion changed about the Jews in Israel? And I think on a whole, it probably has. And of course, with the country making no effort to stop it, well, with the exception of the recent halting of destruction there. But I think that's affected, and again, not just people in Israel, it's affected people worldwide who have viewed that as, that's their opinion of what Jews are. And that's what you're seeing today.
And I'll just add to that I think it's affected Jewish people's ideas about the state of Israel. I sat and listened to two men who come to the coffee shop that I frequent yesterday, sitting and debating, can Jewish people be anti-Semitic? And it was all around what was going on with the government of Israel versus what was going on with the thinking of Jewish people about the state of Israel and about their identity and how their identity is being seen in the world and the difficulty of separating the identity of the state of Israel and the political leaders of the state of Israel from the identity of Jewish people.
And those people who were discussing it were Jewish.
Yes, yes.
That's such an important point. You can tell I'm kind of been involved in this topic for decades now. But I hope you all remember that Tree of Life was not the first anti-Semitic mass murder in Pittsburgh. Richard Baumhammer's went around, and you knew it had to be someone who was targeting Jews because he, one of the places he targeted was Ahavath Akim in Carnegie. And if you don't know where that is, then you couldn't know that that was a synagogue if you didn't know. For a number of years, I wrote the Yom HaShoah programs for Shim, and one of those happened not long after the Baumhammer's rampage. And, you know, I'm a middle-class white girl from the South Hills of Pittsburgh. What do I know? Presbyterian. But when we went there that night, the security we had to pass, and I remember they have windows behind the Bima, and there was more security than we'd ever had at Yom HaShoah before. And during the course of that commemorative service, with the way the lighting was, you could see the police patrolling past the windows. That's going to stick with me for a really long time because I've never had to experience that. Presbyterians don't get targeted like that. But the fact that that happens, and every year when we still had the programs and I would go, the security is unbelievable to get in there. You may not remember, those of you who came to services when they hosted us a couple of years ago at Temple, it makes you think differently. They are a target. They are still a target. And some of them are religious Jews, and some of them are what they would call cultural Jews. But Ted's point was absolutely spot on. There is a difference between Judaism and Zionism. There's a difference between those two things and the current government of Israel. And what gets lost in all this, when we did the one-hit wonder, I kept saying, read a book. Because Palestine was offered a country. They were offered a nation. They didn't get everything they wanted, so they chose to push it off. So when I listen to these debates, we want a country. Okay, you were offered one. You said no because you didn't get everything you wanted. So I was aggravated at the No Kings protest yesterday with people who had their scarves on. And I want to say, first of all, pick one topic and stick to it. But understand you need to read more about what you're talking about. We are in such a social media age that people will see a tweet and they think that that's the whole story, and it's not. And so we as a church could be better about, maybe we offer a couple of seminars. I know you guys have this year all planned, but maybe we look at a Wednesday night series for a month that says, here's what happened with the partitioning back in the 40s, where there was a Jewish state, there was a Palestinian state. And one of the reasons that Israel expanded when it did is because they were attacked. And yes, the numbers are horrific in what's happened in the last 2 years. There's no excuse for what the Israeli government has done, but they were reacting to an attack upon them. And we need to also keep that in mind.
Let me just ask anyone online who wants to contribute to the discussion to not be shy. Unmute yourself and just pipe right up. While we wait for that, John?
Very briefly, there's a difference between religion and religions. And I think nothing Jesus preached can say that there's a us and them. There is no them. There's only us. To say that I'm a Christian and they're a Jew, that violates Jesus, I think, message that there is no them.
That's excellent. And that leads me right to my next point. And Jeff, you can talk too. But do we kind of downplay the fact that Jesus was Jewish and all his close associates were Jewish? Jesus wasn't a Christian. He was a Jew. And now, but Jesus himself, and as we look at Jesus, he was a Jew. Yeah, and some of our art over the centuries that has depicted Jesus with long blonde hair, for example, in the 19th century. No, that wasn't correct. Well, he has no label, but he labeled himself as a Jew, a practicing Jew. Yeah. And so, Jeff.
Wouldn't this conversation make a lot more sense if we had members of one of the Jewish synagogues come and participate with us? It's nice to hear one side, and we're hearing one side here pretty much, but to hear their experiences and what they're going through personally would make a lot more sense. And not just their rabbi, but I'm talking about just a portion of their congregation, just have an evening where they come and participate and they can put their two cents in, and you might hear some things that you never thought about.
Oh, I think that's an excellent idea. And we have had interfaith seminars as recently as a couple of years ago. And the One Hit Wonder coming up on Wednesday night has the rabbi from Temple Emmanuel. And we'll keep that going. But this, as you know, today wasn't exactly planned. We were going to learn from the biblical scholarship of Stephen Toole. So we're doing our best to...
When we talk about anti-Semitism, again, it's just coming from our viewpoint. Debbie, my wife, travels a lot with her friend, Debbie Levine. And listening to Evie, and they travel a lot internationally. And Evie is afraid to tell people her last name for fear that she be classified as a Jew. This is just a single person traveling and her experience. How many of you would even think of that? You know, would you be afraid to travel and tell people your name for fear you'd be classified as a Jew?
Good point. And I recall when the incident occurred recently in London, hearing a Jewish person talk about being on the underground when he heard the news, and his immediate reaction was to remove his yarmulke and think, you know, look over his shoulder. What is going to happen to me? And his wife called him and said, where are you? Are you safe?
I'm pretty simpleton here, and I'm a little confused. Jesus was born a Jew, but then he became a Christian because of his whole belief in his faith. So I'm not sure. I'm getting confused with saying that Jesus was a Jew. He was born a Jew. He'll always be a Jew, but he was a Christian, and that's the religion he was professing.
He founded a new religion, yes.
So he's always going to be a Jew.
But the word Christian is nowhere in anything he wrote. He talked that was reported.
But they basically don't believe that he is the Son of God. So from a religious perspective, that is a big, big difference. I'm not saying it causes all the conflict and all the resentment, but I get a little confused when people say he was a Jew. Absolutely, he was a Jew. He was born a Jew, but he was the founder and professing Christianity, which the Jews don't accept. So that's where there has to be some line of demarcation, I think.
But he died a Jew also.
Yeah, he was a cultural Jew. And he did. He was the Son of God. He was the Messiah. They were expecting the Messiah. They did not ultimately accept that he was the Messiah. And that's where there was the split. But as Amy Jill Levine pointed out, Jews even now can greatly respect what Jesus did and how it reflects very favorably on their scriptures.
I guess I'm not grasping the significance of that. He always was a Jew, but the basic of Christianity is he's the Son of God. Jesus is the Son of God, and the Jews don't believe that. That doesn't mean that you can't respect the other religions, but that's a basic difference that I'm not sure where his Jewish background makes any difference there. It makes a difference, but it's a whole new religion. And I'm not saying one's better than the other, but I'm not sure I understand.
Most of the early Christians were all Jewish. They were Jewish Christians.
Huh? Pardon me?
They were Jewish. As a matter of fact, they stayed somewhat Jewish. That's what Levine pointed out. They didn't have to. Then Paul went to the, and others went to the Gentiles, and the Gentiles did not have to adopt all the Jewish practices because they were Gentiles, not Jews, but they were again, most of the first Christians, so to speak, were Jewish.
It just helps us to understand Jesus' background as he grew up as a man, I think. It's just helps us to understand the context. That's all.
I'll just add that it is right to be confused or to find this confusing.
Sure.
For the simple reason that what Chip is pointing to is a central mystery of our faith. God was born fully human, and yet he was fully God. Is he a member of a particular religion, or is he over and above any kind of religion because he is God, but also at the same time, human?
100% God, 100% human. That's
going back just a little bit, you know, I didn't really focus on this as a youngster. I knew there were Jewish people at the synagogues and things, but what I did sense is that the Jews very much want to stick together. They're clannish. They want to, and I think there was a lot of resentment that as part of that, they were very successful people, and they were very driven. They were successful. They often became wealthy, and I think there was a lot of envy or the jealousy that built up. And often the Jewish people, it was perceived that they would take every advantage they could of you, particularly in the business sense, and not necessarily share that and not necessarily incorporate themselves into the rest of the world. Other, you know, you could say you grew up an Italian, you grew up a German or whatever, but I think that that's the sense I had there, that they were successful people, very smart, that people believe that, but they very much were cliquish and clannish, didn't necessarily want to mix with other individuals, and they took advantage of the economic success and wealth that they had. And a lot of people resented that. And I think that was sort of the perception I had growing up. I'm not saying I agree with it. That was the perception I had.
Well, I think that's right. And I will just say that my wife would say to me early in our marriage, when we met and married in the South, "Oh, you're not from the South. You're a Yankee." Or when I moved to Pittsburgh, I would hear from people, "You're not from around here, are you?" And this is just human to try and identify who is this that I'm dealing with before I get to know them.
I have to clarify something, and I can understand why people have this perception. It is not that Jews want to be apart and want to be clannish. They did that for self-protection. They were in shtetls. They were in communities of their own because they were not accepted. So they don't want to be clannish and to themselves. They have been forced into that for their protection.
From an economic perspective, they were jealous because they were typically successful. They were typically ruthless in their success.
Those are tropes. They are not the truth. So again, there's lots of scholarship out there, but repeating that is one of the reasons we have anti-Semitism.
I'm saying that what my observations were, what I believe. Why do other people have that opinion? That's my belief. That's why other people have it. Am I going to resent the Jews and success? No, I'm proud of them. I'd like to emulate their success. But if you're asking me why I think a lot of people, at least in the States, in the United States, have always resented the Jews, is because they're successful. They're envious.
And to clarify, you're saying that people have that thought, that they are, and that's not, you're not saying that that is your thought. No. But those thoughts prosper until you step back and say, well, you know, I know some Jews in New York who struggle to get by, drive a cab, work at a hot dog stand or whatever. It's just, you know, it's just when you're trying to talk about a group of people in the abstract, you can construct all these things that have nothing to do with individuals.
Okay, let's close with something that's really very practical. Have you encountered anti-Semitic opinions in your work and social life? So this kind of, like, do you see people exhibiting this in your daily life, at your parties? Do you interact with Jews? Do you hear anti-Jewish opinions? What's your experience been? We've got about 5 minutes left.
Anyone online?
I was going to say that has all changed. You know, maybe 15, 20 years ago, you would hear some comments made, but it seems like that's all faded away. And we're talking about Klanish also. I was just thinking about the book, that why are all the black kids sitting together in the lunchroom? You know, again, self-protection. It's not necessarily they want to be there all by themselves, but that's what happens. You get pushed away.
Chip, you're one of the best Christians I know. So that was not, I can't even bring myself hardly to say it, but I hear a conversation out loud. I'm going to Jew him down. And that infuriates me. And that's, well, because I made myself say that, which is difficult. So it's out there. And the point I want to make is we need to be the ones to push back on that. Jews can't protect themselves. We have to help them do that. Jews really respect Christianity far more often than Christians are protective of Jews.
That's a good point. If you recall 9/11, so long ago, Westminster, in response to that, established a group. It was part of the peacemaking group that wanted to study the children of Abraham, the three faiths, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And we had a gathering in Fellowship Hall to kick that off, and we had representatives of the three faiths. And it was a wonderful night of unity, respect, healing, and we kept these kinds of events going for a while. And then when Jim Gilchrist was here, he started the Jewish Christian Dialogue, which drew lots and lots of people on a weekday at lunchtime. So I think Westminster has done a good job. And I guess at this point, we just want to keep going and maybe increase what we do. And as we remember the Tree of Life, just because it's the most recent and that's kind of in the news, particularly today. I think it's something that is so horrible. It's maybe important to keep it with us so that we don't forget how horrible that can be. So any other thoughts about your work, your social life? My parties are really dull, so I don't hear anything.
Comment. I used to get my hair cut by a couple of old Italian barbers. And back when Obama was running for president, one of them said to me, "You know, Jeff, I'm not prejudiced. I just couldn't vote for a black man for president." I thought that was an interesting comment.
Yeah.
I remember the days of the Nixon-Kennedy debates, and I heard people saying, "How can you possibly vote for a Catholic? I mean, because he'll be controlled by the Pope, you know." So that's been going on forever.
Yeah.
Us versus them.
Well, maybe that's a good place to leave it. Amen. Thank you for participating. And we do hope that Steve Toole will be back next week.
Thank you, everyone.
Good. He's had a really good perspective.